by Satanic International Network. You're listening to The Ooze.
Upon decaying every foul wicked spirit in the host, The Ooze.
20 minutes, that Dorove on The Ooze, spread out.
On The Ooze, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
The whole point.
To really tap into have a serial crime
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now onto our show.
Okay, welcome to Saturday night's edition of The Ooze. Sorry, I just realized that I had the episode playing on my headset also. There's like a 10-second lag. I'm TC Downey, I'm the host of Your Ooze, and Dan Dredd will be along here shortly. We've run into some kind of technical difficulty, and I'm still kind of trying to figure out what the deal is. I don't know if I need to back out here and Skype in via the guest number, or if Dan can just go ahead and click the button on the chat room and the guest page there. But yeah, as usual here on Blog Talk Radio, we're having technical difficulties. So here we go. Let's see. All right, so what do we got going here? Dan. Okay, Dan, I'm going to back out and call in off the show's episode page. So if you want to go ahead and Skype in, we'll get this all straightened out here real quick, and then we'll go from there. Okay, I'm back, and hopefully Dan Dredd can find his way to calling into the host here in the next couple of minutes, and we can get things on the road. In the meantime, Saturday night, I've had a little bit of, partaking in the cause and all that good stuff, but I'm most certainly not at a point, I don't know, mentally, where I can't figure out what the hell's going on with the Skype thing. I think Dan must be having technical difficulties on his end. Dan, if you can hear me, just you're obviously signed into the chat room. If you could, well, no, you might not be, actually, now that I mention it. I might well be signed into the chat room. Holy cow. What a big mess on Saturday night. Awesome. First 5 minutes of the show, technical difficulties. Second 5 minutes of the show, technical difficulties. We'll kind of go from there. At least Kenny will be able to keep up this way. He'll, he knows we're having trouble, and that's all he'll need to know. Don't worry, Kenny, we're still going to talk. It just might take a minute for that to happen. So, tonight I decided to just indulge myself a little bit and do something I rarely do anymore. Damn.
Oh, man. Let's just write this one up to technical difficulties, my friend. I apologize for the last 7 minutes.
That's all right, bro. I figured as much. I decided I'd just go ahead and back out and let you call in as host. I Skyped in at the last second when I saw you hadn't made it to the studio, I guess is what we got to call that shit now. But here we are. We're ready to go. How's your evening this evening?
Oh, not too bad, man. Not too bad. I'm just taking it easy, you know. I like to do as little as possible on my weekends, drinking a little bit of Bacardi and Coke. And, it's a good night, Beast. It's a good night, other than this the last, you know, say 10 minutes.
Right on. Well, as I was saying, just before you kind of stepped on, I decided tonight to go ahead and grab my whetstone and again put in a real fine edge on my knife. So I haven't done that in a real long time. It'd be like kind of a meditative thing that I would do. And as I was doing it, I looked up and realized what the topic was that we had agreed upon, and realized that there was like this heavy correlation between the two things.
You know what? I was actually just thinking the same sort of thing. I don't know if I've told you this or not, but I've lately been getting heavily back into my kung fu training. I used to be right in the kung fu, and I was doing the Sui Lim Tao, which is the first form of Wing Chun kung fu, which is it's very slow and meditative for the first half. And it occurred to me that that is the definition of true experiential knowledge. Like that is something you can know. You can really know yourself through that process. On a more visceral level than you really can, like, know, say, something from a book, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a real numinous process, you know, getting back in touch with, you know, basic reality. I don't know if I'm really doing justice to the concept of the words I'm choosing here, but I think you know what I'm saying.
I certainly do. Actually taking the time to finally sharpen something and have taking the time to just kind of put yourself into this meditative process, it has a whole hell of a lot to do with what we're talking tonight about, and at least in my opinion. One of my theories has always been that, I'm trying to get this pieced all together. We're kind of coming at this sideways, but the idea of taking your time and really thinking about processes. I mean, the whole concept of cognition is it's a certain process of knowing, but it's deeply and intricately attached to perception. But at the same time, it's the emphasis is on the process part of it, on that step-by-step knowing and step-by-step doing. That's one of the things that I can really appreciate about martial arts, is that, each of these things that they have, there's a process to it. There's a build-up that happens.
Yeah, exactly. In the process of, say, kung fu, I can't speak for other martial arts, but when you're doing the first form or any movement, it's a very heavy emphasis on correct structure and correct form, where you will, you know, concentrate heavily on what every part of your body is doing, every cell, every fiber, so you know exactly what you're doing and where you are, right down to, you know, and sometimes this is a very slow, you know, meditative process to sort of gain this awareness, but it's that is the true definition of knowing something.
Right on, and I think a lot of the stuff that you and I talk about all kind of really goes back to this. I think it's something that we're both deeply interested in. The idea of, you know, having an idea and allowing it to kind of go through this process of gritting up against the whetstone, so to speak, and you know, creating a razor fine edge on it. It's more numinous than one person might think, and I like that you chose to use that word tonight, because it's something that I think is very expressive of what we're talking about in particular. Before we really bop on, though, dude, Zach, I guess, wants me to answer the phone for him, so why don't we go ahead and throw him on real quick?
Yeah, sure, why not? Let's see what Zach has to say.
All right. What's up, big man?
Oh, fuck, Dan finally called in. I was just trying to call in to bail you out. So what's going on?
What's going on, Zach?
So what's our topic here? Philosophical minimalism?
That's right, buddy.
All right.
more importantly, the attachment that it has in the development of cognition. I watched a video a while back on YouTube that I thought had a really, really cool little slogan in there, and that was, the more you think about thinking, the better you get when you're thinking, the better at it you are, you know, practice kind of deal.
Well, the more you do anything, the better you get at it. That's definitely a truism.
Right on. I thought that was kind of neat because I think one of the things that really happens with philosophical minimalism, and I don't really mean philosophical reductionism so much as I mean minimalism, needing just the very basics. If you have to make a hairline jump, then that's okay. But if it requires anything more than that in terms of assumption, I think that you're kind of faulty in putting any kind of real trust into it.
That's very true. And you know what? I think we should establish first, because generally when people hear the expression philosophical minimalism, they will make a lot of assumptions. So I'd like to first specify what I do not mean when I say philosophical minimalism. I'm not going to speak for you, but I have a feeling you'll probably agree with most of this. People tend to associate this term with meaning that, you know, you only believe the minimum and you will not believe, you know, certain things no matter what. But it couldn't be any further from the truth. It's more of a establishing a solid position from which to examine, you know, this ocean of things and ideas and experiences that we have at our fingertips. But I just think it's very dangerous to just believe anything, you know, to have a low standard of evidence and just allow anything to become truth to you. Because at that point you become, you know, far removed from bedrock. And I think striving for bedrock is very important. That's the whole key to philosophical minimalism for me, is to strive for bedrock at all times.
Okay, you see, I was under the impression that philosophical minimalism basically meant that in your own particular paradigm of philosophy, you really are only interested and take note of things that directly pertain to the self, or, you know, yeah, indulging of the self and kind of disregard anything that doesn't really have a direct influence on your life.
Well, that would be one interpretation, but that's not what I mean when I talk about it. I mean, you can gain good knowledge about things that in no way affect your own life. But if you were to study them or experience them and gain, you know, a good understanding of them and, you know, burn away ideas you might have had about them before through experience or through, you know, encountering better knowledge or through intense scrutiny or what have you, it's the same thing as whether it applies to your life directly or does not. It's just it's a principle. It's the autodiabolic method.
A while back, I guess even during my stay in the Cult of Cthulhu, I wrote this little article, this little essay. It's on my website if anybody wants to check it out. The essay is called A Basis in History, and what I tried to do was establish some way to determine, you know, the factual reality of something that happens in a long distance, time-wise, a linear long distance from yourself. What I mean is that if something happened, say, 4,000 BC, your ability to actually trust, you know, the event as the stories are told or whatever, it's greatly dampened the fact that so much of a distance of time has passed from the period in which it happened to the point which you are now examining it from.
Well, certainly that, and the fact that only a certain amount of people would be qualified to interpret that data, then you have to take their words for it, and of course they will probably come to different conclusions than each other, so then you have to choose between these conclusions based on these things that you don't really have a solid understanding of yourself. Much of science is like that. We kind of have to sort of take people's words for things. But there again, that's why I think it's important to be philosophically minimalistic, is in if you don't directly know about something, don't have too much faith that it's true.
Right. Well, I kind of wrote up some bullet point guidelines as to what things I thought gave you the ability to come closer to historical factuality. And I think the reason that I'm sharing this is its process itself is something very similar to the same kind of process that I view putting in motion when you're using a philosophical minimalist position like you're referring to or like you're discussing. So I thought maybe if you didn't mind, we might just kind of run down these bullet points and talk about them a little bit.
Sure. I'm not gonna shit on your dinner plate, man. Let's do that.
One of the ideas that I had in mind was we've already kind of discussed it. It's the proximity of origin, and the idea of this is that the further away from you the event is, either time-wise, distance-wise, or experience-wise, that the harder it would be for you to come to some kind of comprehensive accuracy. So that's the first thing, and I kind of already hit on that a little bit. You know, we don't know what really went down in ancient Rome because, well, we weren't there. You know.
Well, I think for as far as knowledge goes, there is a scale of gray when it comes to, you know, secondhand knowledge by proxy being, you know, knowledge from other people, knowledge through scrutiny, and actual direct experience. Now, you just can't substitute direct experience. Now, obviously, we can't have direct experience for ancient events, so we're kind of reduced to relying on the first method in that case.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, I'm not saying that this means that you should absolutely abandon any established idea of what transpired during that time period, but rather I'm saying that you cannot, in your mind, kind of commit any one thing as being absolute fact.
Oh, absolutely. I personally see history as a series of probabilities, you know. Certain things, you look at not just the history, but the people that wrote it and the reasons they might have had for writing it, and then you can sort of extrapolate what might have happened. A lot of the times it's, you know, it might not be exactly what you're supposed to believe, but either way, we have no way of really knowing in these kind of situations, right? Like, how are you going to know what Caesar, you know, Augustus, you know, like to have for dinner? You know, how are you going to know something like that? You just can't, right?
Right on. And I think that you can use this even in a more physical sense to give yourself what might be called the raw bones frame for whatever it is that you're trying to understand at this point. You know, like, for instance, if you were, I don't know, examining Crowley's magic, you know, you would need kind of to use this idea of what ideas are closest to your own thinking and what ideas are the furthest away. And then when you find those ideas that are the furthest away from your own thinking, most of the time that means that you can kind of give them a heavy grade of skepticism because their proximity of origin is further than the others.
I think another important standard is whether it can be measured against real-world events for authenticity. Like, when you're talking about something like the writings of Crowley, which is, you know, this is just my opinion, of course, but largely just gobbledygook, where it's just sort of talking, you know, philosophical masturbation, where it doesn't really connect to anything in the real world. It's hard to evaluate. Then it's just a matter of aesthetics at that point. But I find it's important to be able to measure something against real-world events, to try to attain truth value from said thing.
Right on. And that's actually another stage in here that I talk about, which is like plausibility verification. You know, could it happen in real world? Could you reconstruct it and kind of make it happen?
Yeah, well, of course. If you can make it happen, that means it's possible. And if it's possible, then, well, it's possible. You know, so that definitely ups the chances that it might be true. It's definitely one method.
So that's one of the other bullet points, actually, and you kind of touched on it. The actual integrity of the testimony that you're listening to is another thing that, you know, like the source, can you put stock in what he says? Does what he say most of the time hold some grain of truth? Now, these are just things of measure, you know. You can go, okay, 50-50, sometimes this guy's full of shit, sometimes he's right on the money. Well, that means what he's saying to me now has a 50-50 chance of being correct, you know.
That's actually a double-edged sword, though, because sometimes someone that you trust immensely or that has only ever given you true information might pass something along to you. And, you know, given the source, you might not look at it, that thing or that idea, as hard as you might otherwise. And, you know, in that way, one might slip by you, so to speak. You know, I think it's important to look hard at everything. Even if someone I trust or someone that I highly respect intellectually is to pass on an idea to me, I will subject it to the same fire as I would an idea from anyone else.
Oh, certainly. And I'm not suggesting that just because the value of the testimony from this person is, you know, it sways greatly to, let's say, always positive.
It does affect the probabilities, though. I think that's what you're trying to say. I'm just being argumentative.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I'm saying. I'm dealing directly with the probability of getting misinformation. You know, it is lowered greatly, but always obviously statistically relative or statistically possible.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Like, if, say, Jason King were to tell you something about, you know, some sort of obscure Hindu sect and their sort of obscure left-hand path philosophy they might have been following, you know, I'd be inclined to believe that was true. You know, even while researching it to make sure, I would go in thinking that it was probably true because he knows about that kind of thing. You know, whereas if I heard that from, say, I can't even name a name, but so someone that obviously wouldn't know, you know, you'd look a little harder.
Right on. The next thing I think that you would use is to examine the tendency of bias in whatever information you're receiving, you know, and that would deal greatly more with where it's coming from, what angle it's being pitched to you from. You know, like, for instance, a Jehovah's Witness giving you, you know, some kind of information on what historical Jesus looked like. You know, they may well have a tendency of bias there and therefore present facts that have been misconstrued over time.
Well, that's true of
sure,
everyone, I
sure.
suppose. Go ahead, Zach.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. If you look at, like, all the millions of books that have been sold, written by Christian evangelists, supposedly, you know, who are now experts on Satanism and experts on satanic ritual abuse and shit, and this shit's coming out of the mouth of Christians, and, you know, even, I don't know, I never understood that, how people would turn to a source like a TV evangelist to get their info on something like Satanism. I mean, clearly the author of the book is going to be heavily biased. I mean, why would you trust anything this fucker says?
Well, you have to remember that the people that are trusting this information are the same people that trust these evangelists as men of God, because these are the people that believe in God and believe that these evangelists are inherently good people. Why would these Christian evangelists that represent Jesus lie to me? That's just absurd. Obviously, they're going to be telling the truth about these awful Satanists. You know, you got to remember that the people that are listening aren't exactly in the same mindset as you and I.
Well, that's true. That's true. I can answer that question. Why would they lie? Five letters. Money.
Well, I mean, that's a rhetorical question. I know full well why they would lie, but as, like, say, a devout Christian, you might not think that way. You'd think that, well, these are men of God. If I can trust anyone, I can trust Pat Robertson. You know what I'm saying?
That's true.
But whereas, like, someone like you or I might look at that same Christian evangelist and think, fuck, he's got a good scam going on. How do I get some of that action?
Right on. The next thing, if I can kind of just push this along, because I didn't want to tie the whole show up with it. The next thing is the detail versus general analysis. You know, how general is the information you're receiving, how much detail is actually being provided. It gives you the ability to actually make a quicker determination as to the factuality or authenticity of whatever it is that you're receiving at the time. You know, I guess if someone can sit there and say, you know, you go, oh, I don't know what's wrong with my car, and they listen to it, and they're able to give you more detail as to why they think whatever problem is their problem, the more detail they can give you, the more of the chances that the information that they're giving you is going to be factual.
Oh, are you referring to, like, say, someone that calls in sick for work and gives you some kind of cockamamie excuse, but yet doesn't provide enough detail, really, to make it a credible story, or, like, sort of trips over their own story? Yeah, no, you see that all the time. If you pay attention to detail, it's sometimes quite easy to tell when people are lying to you.
Right. Now, there's also an alternative advantage, and that is that someone who is over-explaining something or giving too much detail, you obviously can't trust that as well, because it's kind of something that people do when they're trying to pass some kind of believability over.
Oh, so, yeah, certainly. Yeah, the other end of the spectrum, is definitely true as well. You know, if someone is, doesn't want to go to work, comes in the next day with this excuse that they've been working on to tell their boss, but it's just, like, so incredibly detailed that it couldn't possibly be true. Yeah, no, I've seen that happen before.
Right. I'm just going to take a look here real quick, see how we're doing out there in the chat room. It looks like we're doing good. Kenny, looks like you might still be following along. I'm proud of you, Kenny. To the next thing here. Can you yourself verify? And I think we already touched this. Can you yourself verify the data being presented? Can you reference it?
That's really the bottom line, right there. That's what passes or fails. You know, if I can verify it through inscrutable scrutiny. if I can use that terminology, I'm going to, or direct experience, you know, and
unscrutably.
Yeah, inscrutable scrutiny, and yeah, and direct experience. So those are the two things that it really comes down to.
Right, and then I think the final one, because I've covered some of the others that I have listed here just through discussing the ones that we were doing. The final one is analogical function. If the information that you're receiving, is valid, it's going to make sense. It's going to fit into a logical sequence of thought.
Yeah, well, that's just, I hate to call it common sense, because that's really a misnomer. But the ability to, rationally, connect abstract thoughts in your head, which is something you'd think everyone would be able to do, but the older I get, the more I conclude that it just isn't so.
Right on. So, well, anyway, that. Go ahead, Ben.
Zach?
Hello?
No. Go ahead, Beast. Obviously, whatever Zach was saying is that important.
I don't know, it's breaking up bad. It sounds almost kind of like some kind of robot porn going on over there, so.
Oh, robot porn, right.
Yeah.
I didn't say nothing.
Okay, there we go. He's busy watching robot porn. Let's leave this guy alone.
Yeah, all right.
So, really, the whole idea behind why I was presenting these bullet points was to show that there was a process that I developed to kind of refine the way that I was thinking about it, and in the process of developing the process, if that makes sense, I'm able to actually cut away a lot of the extra fats that you deal with, so to speak, and get down to what's really just a bare bones way of thinking, a way of dealing with whatever it is that you're looking at that point.
Yeah, well, what you were describing there is just kind of like a vector of critical thinking, and that's I think that's very important, you know, to look at everything very very closely before you assign truth value to it. You know,
right.
And certainly there's criteria you can use, and the criteria you offered are quite good.
Right on. Now, something that I think that we're going to have to deal with here on this show tonight, so that people kind of understand how or why. We made the claim earlier, both you and I did, that this process of actually removing the fat, so to speak, or getting rid of all that nasty, icky, I don't know, let's call it goo from around it, that in itself can be a numinous process. It can be uplifting, and that's something I think probably sounds funny coming from two people who both are pretty hardcore in terms of supporting logical thinking or analytical thinking over intuitive or emotional.
Well, it might seem that way, but it isn't really. Like, I realize that my rational cognition and my intellectual processes are something that's going on in my brain, and I realize that they're good tools for navigating the world. So I realize the value of that. I tend to use these as my primary tools to navigate the world. But I also realize that all of these beliefs and memes that are inside me are forms. They're causal forms. They're not me. They're not my essence. They're not my a causal center. And that is why I like to strip away as much of this garbage that's introduced externally, all these ideas, all these extraneous things that that just sort of clutter up your mind space, so to speak. You know, that's my whole mission, is to reduce all of this garbage and just try to keep the ones that are useful, the ones that are true, the ones that touch on bedrock wisdom. And of course, this is a lifelong process. I mean, we're constantly being bombarded by memetics all the time. And, just to stand your ground and remove the ones that are coming at you, much less the ones that are already inside you, is, like I say, it's a method. It's a process.
Right on. But what about this is numinous? That I think, is what I'm really trying to get to here. I understand why it becomes kind of let me first of all make sure that we both understand the word numinous correctly. Numinous is spiritual in a sense, or mystically inclined.
Well, yes and no. That's one understanding of it. For me, numinous is to be in touch with nature on like a really core level. Like, you can describe this as spiritual, but there's so much baggage attached to the word spiritual, with all these inclinations or all of these ideas of the supernatural and deities and intelligences and this and that and what have you. But I think being numinous is to lay under the stars in the middle of the bush, camping by yourself with no one else around, and just experience nature as it is. To climb a cliff freehand and realize that one false move could be your death, but to do it anyway, and just to feel, to make eye contact with a wild animal.
Right.
That is numinous.
Right. Well, let's tag back here to the word spiritual, because as you know, I handle that word completely different than most people do.
Well, of course you do, Beast, of course. And when I was using it, I was, of course, going with the colloquial definition. Spiritual, as the way you use the word, I can't hate on that, man. Like, as in, like, the spirit of something, the spirit of the game, the spirit of, radio, whatever. Yeah, that's a totally different thing, though.
Right. To me, the word spiritual, and I use this in connection with the term numinous, because I think that you illustrated very well numinous with the example of nature and being in touch with it, being connected to everything. Spirit in itself is that connection. It's that thing inside of you that draws that parallel between whatever it is you are in the spirit of, at that point in time. So.
And under that definition, I find that word to be quite useful. The only thing is, it's quite a different definition than what other people would be using when they're using the word. Basically, it's a synonym for supernatural occurrences, which is in itself a bastardization of the word, but that is, as it is commonly understood.
Well, right.
I don't think we can change that, hey?
Yeah, I would make the argument that the term supernatural in itself is bastardized, just like spirit. I don't think, because supernatural includes the word natural in it, that it's anything separate from what happens in the natural world, but rather it is more potent in the natural world than, say, something that's just natural. So you have you have this, I don't know, this event of a rainstorm, but a hurricane coming along would be supernatural in that sense.
Yes, I prefer the term unknown reality to describe what others might describe as supernatural. Things that actually happen, but are not understood yet. And I realize that there are things that happen that are not yet understood. I mean, we're not that far along. So in that context, it makes more sense. But to use the word supernatural, there again, it's a word that's got so much baggage attached to it. All of a sudden, you say you believe in the supernatural, you believe in crystals, you believe in ghosts, you believe in this, you believe in that, you know, which are all in and of themselves, you know, sort of bastardized beliefs, sort of cartoonized, Hollywoodized. You know what I mean.
I do. I know exactly what you mean, and that's kind of why I'm hitting at it from the angle that I am, and why I suggest the show in the first place, because I think it's really kind of neat to see the parallels between your thinking and my own, and I was kind of hoping that some of that would transpire here on the show, and in itself be kind of insightful for you know, our listeners, so...
Yeah, well, as always, we share some philosophical common ground, quite a bit, even though, as a matter of fact, I would say that a lot of our form differs, but a lot of the essence behind the form is quite the same thing, so I would say that's probably how it is.
Right on. Well, you know, whether you practice Kung Fu or Muay Thai, you're still practicing some form of martial arts, you know?
I did Muay Thai in the past, but Kung Fu is more of a internal experience. I did it for a long time, and just recently I decided that I would get back into it. I'm glad I did.
I think that's a great thing myself. You know, getting back into old things, going back and trying to do things again, things that maybe at one point or another lost their favor is... certainly one way of constantly moving forward, even if it does outwardly appear to be kind of a cycle.
Yeah. So anyway, there was another direction that I wanted to look at this from, so now seems like as good a time as any to bring that shit up.
Yes, sir.
So I will, man. The thing about, you know, philosophical minimalism is it's a counterposition to... or it can be a counterposition to the commonly held position, not only with like occultists or Satanists, but people at large who tend to associate wisdom with complexity. And this is something that goes back to, you know, the old days when the Catholic Church was in charge and they would give their masses in Latin. No one would really know what was going on. It would be so ununderstandable, but in that it would have power. And that people couldn't quite get it, but there was people that got it, so it was true, and you could not question this knowledge, right? And to an extent, that is still going on to this day, you know, to the point where people will often, when they're forming their own worldviews, add countless extraneous layers to any given viewpoint, you know, and clutter their mind to the point of incoherence. But in my mind, I think that is the opposite of true wisdom. I think true wisdom can always be boiled down to simplicity. And from that, you know, at complexity as wisdom, or this sort of mimetic set that has been floating around for a while, you get what my friend Diavolo describes as the apparatus. I don't know if you've heard this term or not, but the apparatus is what Diavolo describes, and it's the term I'm stealing from him now, as it's like the self-supporting and replicating meme set that props up and maintains the status quo. These things that people just sort of take as you know, axiomatic, you know, and this apparatus as, you know, as being unquestionable, as it's, you know, as it's based in all of this information that's too terribly complex for any one person to understand. So it's rife with what I like to call regulative memes, which are accepted a priori because of their source, say, for example, anyone that uses force aside from the agents of state is automatically a bully or a thug, or that those in power have your best interests in mind. I mean, whose best interests? Yours? Mine? Or, you know, other things like just doing my job, as if that excuses all actions taken from that point on. Yeah, you know, and... you know, once truth is established as complexity, the door is open for justifying faith, And, you know, then you get these regulative means, you know, like this knowledge comes from people that are men that are far wiser than you, which is another regulative meme that you shouldn't question, or God or your parents. It's basically a foundational point for what keeps people controlled. Are you driving with what I'm saying, Beast?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. I got to say, man, I was actually just sitting here and chuckling. And so, I guess something you really don't know about me is I have for a very, very long time been interested in certain pseudoscience, which I don't hold a ton of credibility to, but some of the ideas that are presented within it are really fascinating to me. Neurolinguistics programming is what I'm referring to. And I'm just kind of laughing as I'm watching you drop all of these mapping points or hooks, as you would call them, in there. You keep using a certain vocabulary, and I'm chuckling because it might stay in the fourth way, reinforce the idea that a specific vocabulary was something that you could use to really hone the edge of whatever information you were kind of putting out there. But also that specific vocabulary can be used in a very specific way to drop these larger ideas that ultimately are kind of bully-ish, if I can use that term.
Bully-ish?
Bully-ish, yeah.
Oh, you mean like they browbeat you into a certain set of behavior? Yeah, I like to call these regulative memes because they're memes, they're ideas, self-propagating ideas in word form, whatever that sort of, like you say, bully you into a certain behavior. You know, like I say, like, you know, the regulative meme of, you know, men far wiser than you have thought of this, or men far wiser than you have done this or that. You know, and as such, you're not supposed to question that because, oh, well, these men are far wiser than me. So obviously nothing I can reason or nothing I can think of is going to, you know, supersede that. So I must just accept this as true. That's just one example. There's, you know, literally thousands of examples.
Sure. What I was kind of doing, because I do absolutely vibe with what you're saying about these regulatory memes. I had to kind of laugh because those same tools that you're describing and kind of giving warning to, you're employing at the same time. So it's really kind of, I don't know, great. I love it. It's one of my favorite parts about you, Dan.
Well, of course, language is a double-edged sword. It can be used to clearly express, and it can obviously be used to oppress. You know, it's a matter of wielding that weapon. That's we did a whole show about language.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we did.
Yes, we did. If people haven't figured out yet, this is the ooze with a kick right here. So with all that being said and done, we got about 15 minutes left. I really can't think of any one specific thing that we might be able to talk about and stay within those bounds and also relative to the main topic. So if you have something, let's run with it, man.
Ah, well, I mean, you know, just to sort of wrap it up, say, you know, to keep one's subjective door through which truth passes well guarded, you know, causes come to, and this is another regulatory meme, causes some to dredge up the label of closed-minded. You know, if you're not going to believe in crystals, if you're going to just call bullshit right away without listening to my spew about why crystals work, you're closed-minded. And there you go. There's another regulative meme right there. And basically, closed-minded to these people has become a pejorative synonym for having the balls to examine something and reject it as bullshit, right? So I just wanted to point out another example of another regulative meme and how it sort of relates to this. Yeah, you know, it's really a matter of egalitarianism on one hand as well, you know. So long as all ideas are equal and as long as the powers that be, you know, don't deem them a heresy.
Right.
So, once again,
process, which is something that, you know, this whole thing has been about in a way. you know, the process of cognition, it in itself can become very mechanical. So everything that we've really covered today is things that are to be employed with caution and to be employed with mastery. And that's why I kind of thought it was funny and brought up that video where, you know, that the quote was, the more you think about thinking, the better you get at thinking.
Well, I suppose that's true, you know. Use the method on the method, so to speak. You know, refine, you know, steel meets steel, refine steel upon steel. That's true. You know, the more you actually know how to use your weapon, which is your mind, the more you think, the more expressive, you know, terms within your own mind that you can attach to ideas and use that to form other abstract thoughts. Yeah, the better you get at thinking, the more productive you can become. I completely agree with that.
Right. So, just kind of cool because it shows the really the real dimensionality of the world that we live in, and as hard as some people would try to pin it into some dichotomous, monotony, it's not that. There's a whole spectrum of colors between, say, A pole and B pole.
Well, there always is. You know, there's always a shade of gray. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I just like that term colors because I think it maybe I'm a little more capturing. I mean, you get some gray, but life is a very vivid, fascinating, painful thing, you know?
Fair enough. I'm not going to step on your metaphor, brother. It could be colors.
Right on. Any callers, 347-989-1371, if you got something to say about philosophical minimalism or the process of developing cognition, let's get you up here. Otherwise, and Dan can talk about, I don't know, I want to know what's going on in the world of ADM, man. I saw a new blog post this past week go up.
Oh, yeah, man. I got inspired. What can I say? That's just kind of how it goes with me with that, with this whole philosophical, minimalistic position that I'm developing. It sort of goes hand in hand with Pathe Mathos, and this is just the path that I walk, the vector of Satanism that I walk, and I'm writing it down for others that jive with this, right? You know, piece by piece. I could write more, but I like to refine it down to a point where I can say as much as possible in as few words as possible, which again is a form of minimalism. I like to be concise.
I don't know if I actually threw this out there during our language show, or maybe I did, but I recently heard a statistic about the number of words used in a male vocabulary in an average day and the number of words used in a female vocabulary in a number of days. Well, I shouldn't say vocabulary, but in their normal speech in an average day. It's something like 2,000 to 7,000 for a man and 20 to 22,000 for a woman. And I'm just kind of laughing because that makes me think of Nagashiva immediately. And you can see how that
uses. I'm sure he offsets the average a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But there's exceptions to the rule. I mean, I definitely have a larger vocabulary than most of the people in my immediate circle, male or female. That doesn't mean I go around talking like Naga Siva or anything, but, you know, these words are at my disposal.
But right.
I think that, you know, largely males in society are just sort of going about their pre-programmed existence, and for the ones going about their pre-programmed existence, the pre-programmed existence of the male involves a lot less words and reading than the pre-programmed existence of the female. So there you go.
Right on. Well, here's what I think is interesting. Let's say from the design of a repressor, let's say there is actually a repressor out there, a metaphorical one, but whatever. from that standpoint, it seems that the lack of verbal communication, that's commonalities, between the male sex, it would make sense that you would want to pacify that particular sect over the female. You know, the females obviously would be deemed less of a threat.
Well, I think the current system works fairly well. You know what I'm saying? People largely just do what they're told and they go about their existence. And men have, you know, football and hockey and soccer and things like that through which to vicariously, you know, be men. But when it comes to actual living, it's highly discouraged to go out there and, you know, get in the fights or, you know, do testosterone-induced things. Unless, of course, they're highly regulated. You know what I'm saying?
Right on. Well, and that's kind of what I was getting at. There's another statistic that I remember picking up in my critical thinking class in high school, and that was that the average woman was 20 to 30 IQ points smarter than the average man. Now, obviously, there's exceptions to the rule one way or the other, but it made me wonder if their gross overuse of vocabulary had something to do with that development of adaptation that males don't quite reach to.
Yeah, I don't know. I would have to verify that. I mean, in my personal experience, I don't know. I know a lot of stupid dudes, so I guess that's possible. But I really don't have a theory about that. I wouldn't really be able to speculate.
Right. Well, like I said, again, it was just a statistic that I had heard, and obviously if you know, and this is more for the listeners than you, man, but obviously if you guys heard, you know, my little setup there on the basis of history, the proximity of origin immediately, that rule immediately applies. It wasn't something that I verified with my own eyes, and something that I heard from someone who probably heard from someone, you know. But I still thought that was interesting. If it was the case, if it was true, would the catalyst for that variable be the directly correlated to the overuse of language?
Oh, I suppose it's true. I mean, we'll just assume for a second that that statistical data is both accessible and accurate, which you never really know about statistical data. You always have to look at who's funding them. But anyway, I guess it really would explain, the fact that women have statistically, again, you know, you have to trust these statistics, that women have a higher grasp of language. That would also, you know, indicate scoring better on IQ tests. So yeah, sure, I can see the connection.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting and something to kind of put out there. But, with few minutes left in the show or whatever, and just trying to kind of stay a little bit in the focus of the topic, I thought I would put that out there. 5 minutes left till nobody's called in. Wait, Zach's calling back in.
Uh-oh, we got a caller.
Yeah, Gray Bush.
What up, guys?
What's up,
Zach?
Yeah. Sorry, I had to disappear for a little bit. What's going on?
That's all right, man. Did you get finished with the robot porn?
I'm actually working. I'm in my car. I don't know what that sound was. Maybe it was on my head.
It might be. I might secretly be watching robot porn and don't know it.
So Zach watches robot porn while driving around in his car. That's really more information than I needed about Zach, but that's cool.
Yeah. I'm going to talk to you on the phone.
I'm not going to judge it.
Awesome. So how many pizzas have we delivered tonight, man?
I've only been on for 3 hours. This is my 7th, I think.
So it takes 3 hours to deliver 7 pizzas?
Well, it depends on how busy it is. Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Where's my pizza?
Yeah, it's on its way, yeah.
All right, I'll expect it by Tuesday.
Right on. Tuesday. And then you're dealing
with the
charge. Go for it, man.
The trick is, I'm on speakerphone, and it's a $150 fine if a cop sees you on the phone. So I got really aware of, who's driving around looking at me.
Right. Well, that's good. I mean, hopefully you're not, you know, having a couple of drinks and then talking on speakerphone to us as you're driving around looking for cops and delivering pizzas.
No. This is one of the rare oozes that I'm actually stone cold sober.
Wow.
Sober?
Yeah. I think I smoked a bowl like a couple of hours ago, but that wore off a while ago.
Right on.
Oh, Zach, you turned over a new leaf, my friend.
I can give myself a 5-hour point in the day where I'm not consuming vast amount of alcohol.
Right.
Step one, man. Step one, baby steps.
I'm sure your liver's got to be thanking you. I don't think they reject that fast, though.
I really just got to be careful about, obviously you can't show up to work drunk, but even if you show up to work stoned. Last time I showed up to work stoned, I left 2 pizzas on top of my car and drove away and watched them bounce down the street. That was cool.
You're rad, Zach.
You have to go back to your boss and pizzas are all smashed shit, and she looks at you and tell her what happened. And then she gets right in your face, and she starts squinting her eyes and goes, "Are you okay?" Like, I guess, referencing that I was high. Yeah, that I was just really paranoid. I thought she knew and she didn't.
Yeah, I actually have to laugh. We only got about a minute left here before the outro, but I'm going to throw out a quick story. My kid brother, actually, the first time he ever got stoned, paranoided himself out of whatever you want to call it, of secrecy about it. I mean, he came home, he was doing fine, went right to his room, he was sitting up in his room, and somehow he got convinced that mom would think he was stoned, and so he went downstairs and sat on the couch and started trying to converse with her like he would normally do and stuff. Only, you know, it's the first time you've ever been high. Nothing that comes out of your mouth sounds like, you know, it normally would. I mean, it's just the way it is. Everything's, you know, man, you know, it's stuff like that. So it was funny because she was like, "Well, I had no idea you were stoned," but she came and put it right in front of my face. Now I know.
Idiot.
Exactly. Well, if we have anything else, we got 50 seconds. If not, I'll hit the outro.
No, I got some. I got some alcohol to drink, man. I'm gonna get on that. Good show, man. See you next week.
See you next week, bro.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but it's your discretion to come along. Special thanks to Zach Rocky Aroma for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is the creative oddity studio.